Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 3 of season 2 of APIs Unplugged. My name is Matt McLarty. I'm the global leader of API strategy for BuleSoft. And as always, delighted to be joined by Mr. Mike Amundson in Kentucky. Mike, how's Kentucky?
Kentucky is still here. We actually have snow. We've got a few inches of snow, maybe 3 or 4 inches of snow, which is very exciting around here. It's very, very cold, and I love it.
Yes, you Americans, when the snow, one snowflake and everyone's, you know, school's canceled and all that. But I guess not this year. It's already done. Yeah. So, Mike, this is good. The network's working. Your new machine is...
Yeah. Had a little drama beforehand. Let's hope we make it through the episode and we'll be all set.
We've prayed to the network gods. We should there be good. Go. All right. So today's topic, I think, is one that I know is super close to my heart, Mike's heart. Really kind of systems thinking around APIs, really kind of the organic nature of APIs and understanding systems. And we're really happy to have Jean Young as our guest. She is the CEO and founder of Akita Software. Jean, welcome to APIs Unplugged.
Thank you. Thank you. Really glad to be here.
Awesome. So I think that, you know, sometimes I give a little bit of a bio intro or whatever on our guests, but I mean, your background is so interesting and the worlds that you've spanned that I'm just going to kick it over to you for the first question. Like what, your background is in programming language research when you started out, and you have quite a fantastic academic career. Would love to hear your journey from programming language research into this world of APIs.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So I grew up programming. Both my parents were computer scientists. We had, you know, we had a terminal in our house. We had a computer pretty early on. I grew up with BASIC, Visual Basic. But, you know, as someone, I mean, most people don't really think of the things their parents do as that cool. So I didn't really think I was going to become a computer scientist, but I just kept on taking computer science classes. It was kind of the one homework I didn't fall asleep doing. But junior year, I ended up taking compilers, hardware, and programming languages. And that just totally opened my eyes because these things that had kind of been in my life, I didn't think of as particularly cool. And you know, I just took for granted. I came to see them as not as things that were there, but abstractions that I actually had control over. And that was total magic to me because I was like, you know, it's like telling someone who likes cars that they actually don't have to take the car as it comes from the manufacturer, or that they could even design their own cars. And this is really what got me hooked, because I was like, man, well, I would change so many things about programming if I could. So when I was graduating from college, I decided that was what I wanted to make my career out of, because, you know, I was like, well, I program all the time and I don't like a lot of things about it, so I want to make it better. And I graduated college in 2008. This was when most of the industry jobs around programming tools were around perf, performance. And so there were compiler jobs. Most of the dev tooling jobs out there were really about making compilation faster, compiling faster programs, making the, you know, the compiler itself go faster, things like that. And I wanted to go after the problem of how can we make programming easier, because I felt like, you know, as a kid, when you write kid programs, they're all really nice and simple and fun. And every time I worked in a company, it was, you know, messy. It was really hard to change anything. There were just so many things that it seemed like, you know, using everything we know now, we can improve a lot of stuff about programming. Mm-hmm. And so this is what led me to go to grad school. Although I think a lot of people are like, you know, I was the first person, didn't know what a PhD was. Like most people in my family had PhDs too. So this was not like a big accomplishment.
And so, it was a given.
Yeah. So I was like, okay, you know, I guess I'll go to grad school for this. And so I did my PhD on programming languages for the reasons that I stated. And most of the work in programming languages research is really about how do you design a language, or how do you analyze a program that's in a specific language and, you know, get certain properties about it? How do you get better guarantees about correctness, or, you know, things that you can measure? So perf is one thing you can measure. I already knew I wasn't interested in that. And so correctness or guarantees are the other thing you can sort of measure. And I got into that. And but the one thing that I started thinking a lot about was it seemed like everything in programming languages research didn't encompass the reasons why programming was hard. And so what do I mean by this? It's that, you know, for my PhD, I made this new programming model. It was for information flow security guarantees. That's not totally relevant to this, but I implemented it as an embedded domain specific language because, you know, like all, when you design a language, it's application level, it's all enclosed. And then I tried to build web apps out of it. And so if you've built web apps before, you know that you have your application and then you have your database. And then when I call it out to the database, I was like, oh my gosh, everything that I assumed about life is not what the whole world is. I was like, all of the interesting interactions in this whole program are database calls. And I had spent, you know, 1 year, 2 years at this point designing my language, implementing my language. And I was like, oh no, this is the worst day of my life. Everything is a lie. This is so bad. And so I went into a multi-year existential crisis where I was like, I thought that I could make programming better by designing stuff at the application layer, but everything interesting happens cross component. And so it's not just databases, but you have, like, you know, dozens of different kinds of databases, and you have RPC calls. Every time you do a remote procedure call, you're completely subverting the semantics of whatever you just designed. And so my next paper was actually, this is how we extend our nice programming model to the database. But I was like, no, I'm going to die before I finish modeling all databases. And so this was really my journey to APIs. And this is why when I met Matt and when I first saw Mike talk, I loved what they were saying, because it had been the reason I got into APIs as well. Because towards the end of my multi-year existential crisis, I was like, okay, we have to shift up one abstraction level, because doing all this work at the application level isn't getting at the main problem, which is you have this complexity of modern systems. You've got this emergent behaviors, really, because there's just so many parts moving around. I can get into this later, but if you're doing everything at the detail of the language, that's kind of like modeling the universe, you know, the atom level. Some people do that, and that's important too, but you're not going to get the whole universe that way. And what I like, you know, every time I had programmed and thought it was hard, it was at the whole universe level. It's like stuff breaks in one part because, you know, you didn't know that something happened in some really far away part. And so I came to realize that, well, I was really worried about this multi-component thing, but there had been really nice standardizations on API protocols kind of during the time that I was having this multi-year existential crisis. It had really improved. And so it's a really good strategy. Sometimes if you just come out of your multi-year existential crisis, you're like, wow, the world has fixed itself. And so
I love that yeah. particular strategy. I really love, let just wait, let somebody else carry the weight for a while.
It's like the bell bottoms hang on to them in case they come back in the style. Having the crisis, just wait long enough and it'll work itself out.
Actually, really, really fascinating. We were talking just before the show that we've each meant to connect with each other several times. I was just going over some stuff that I did a long, long time ago, which was actually writing a kind of macro language for TI assembly language back in like the years I don't want to confess. But I had the same sort of situation. I had the same sort of journey. Like, this is way too hard, writing assembly. Yeah. So let me make this better. And I spend all this time creating this sort of macro language that looks a lot like BASIC. You know, it's simple statements. But the TI is a weird machine. It's got like 11 registers. It's all sorts of crazy stuff. But you bury all that. And then I think my world is fine. Then somebody says, oh, you got to read off the disk.
There's always something else.
Right? So the same sort of thing occurs to me that you're talking about. And that's really fantastic that, I mean, I don't have a PhD. I never did these depths that you did. But I think a lot of people go through these same stages. They realize, oh, it's not just my world. It's everybody's world. I have to interact in all of these ways. And that gives you a really, really different perspective on a lot of this stuff. You're not locked in. You're actually wandering around. So this sort of formal academics, this academic world where you got the chance to, as you say, experience your crises as, you know, however they come along, meets up with the reality of real engineering, right? So once you do that, what happens next? I mean, what was it like I don't know, when you came out of the crises or whatever, you now sort of have this, I would say, does it seem to you an unusual perspective or a perspective that is a little bit different than most of us, most of the colleagues that you work with?
In academia, oh, for sure. I was a professor in Carnegie Mellon before right. I left academia, and Carnegie Mellon is so one of the main guys there. He is a type theory purist, and so you know people describe a certain part of type theory as worshiping at the altar of this guy. And so you can imagine the degree to which many of these people were really about creating beauty out of types. It was very much applied logic, very much, you know, we're doing really clean things so that the world can take them and admire. And there were two problems I was getting into that people in academia just weren't generally, or people in academic programming languages. There's a separate discipline called software engineering that it was more into it. But there are two problems I was getting into that the people around me weren't. One was what I'll call the software heterogeneity problem. It's the fact that it's not just one application or runtime. It's so many all talking to each other. The second one is the legacy code problem. So I gave a talk once and about things I was working on in academia, and someone came up to me after the talk and he said, you know, I love these talks from you people. but the problem is you talk as if we could just start over. It's, you know, we can't. We have all these piles of legacy code. And my PhD advisor once said it's like going to the doctor and the doctor saying, well, it's like if you had eaten an apple a day and exercised every day since birth, you just wouldn't need to come here right now. And people are like, okay, this is, doesn't help me. And so I became convinced these were the two hardest problems to solve. And I increasingly became aware that I needed to work with other companies, or I needed to work with companies to solve this problem, because I couldn't just solve it in a vacuum. I also needed a community that cared about solutions to these problems. And so to me, that was not in academia. So in spring of 2018, I actually... I filed for leave. It was multiple steps. So I filed for leave because I was thinking about it, and I had a group at the time. You have to tell your group you're thinking about filing for leave. And so I told them, hey, you know, I might not be around. So the responsible thing to do is probably find a co-advisor. And then, you know, once you have that, you have no one to work with anymore. And so I was like, well, I've got no students and I've got no job coming up. So I should probably give my apartment to someone. And then I had nowhere to put my furniture anymore. So I sold all my furniture to the person I gave my apartment to. And then at that point, I just packed up my car and drove out to the Bay Area because there's really nothing left to do. And so I think sometimes people say, well, you know, like, what was the decision like? And I say, well, it wasn't a decision. It was just a series of logical next steps given what happened the day before.
It's all incremental, isn't it?
Yeah.
We get these kind of moments of duality, right? Where you kind of are like, oh no, everything I thought was true is, you know, my whole truth, my whole being has been undermined by this, some sort of epiphany. Mm-hmm. But then that opens up new possibilities, right? And then maybe, as Mike said, I think that you do have that grounding in formal methods gives you a perspective that I think, I think our industry, a lot of it is, you know, we have a lot of pragmatists who have done great work and, you know, are more likely to bring in the duct tape and the WD-40 than necessarily taking a step back and looking at the big picture. But I think that's why I think it's so interesting that you've had that experience with a foot in both camps, right? And I know on other talks that you've given, you've talked about how this kind of split personality of by day looking into these formal methods and then in your spare time coding with whatever's simplest and easiest to go with. But I think there was a quote you had in a blog you wrote last July. It might have been the first Akita blog, right? About the problem is that modern software systems are entire rainforests, but all our tools measure single trees, right? And I think in there, maybe that's where in the academic world, they're so microscopically focused on the different species of trees, maybe, and right? But the reality, especially in enterprise software and most big organizations applying software, is you've got these massive combinations of not only technology and data and applications and networks, but also the people that are working on them, right? It really is this kind of biological, mm-hmm. biological thing. So I think what's interesting to me is you went through these this formal process, you collided with the reality of engineering, and you, you know, to oversimplify things to an extreme degree, you decided that APIs had some sort of magical property in dealing with this, right? So what, in your opinion, and I know Mike and I have gone on record many times, what do you think makes APIs so special in that rainforest context?
Well, this is related to how you and I first connected on Twitter, Matt, where you you made the observation that what Akita was going after was we were going after shoring up the interfaces of the system. And so, you know, if software systems are these rainforests, there's how the trees relate to the monkeys, relate to the birds, and the APIs are really, you know, capturing that relationship, that communication. And so what was really magical to me about APIs was it didn't really matter, you know, what the monkey's feeling or thinking. It just matters, you know, how he's sitting on the tree, what he's doing to the tree. And that simplification really lets you kind of abstract out a lot of details that could otherwise be overwhelming in a system. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of tools out there. I've been told I shouldn't throw classes of other tools under the bus. So I'm trying to be as nice as possible here. But you know, if you think about source code scanners, that's kind of like you know, does the monkey have some patches of fur that are like not doing well, or you know, like very very monkey centric situation here. And then there's other stuff like, you know, is the overall volume level of the rainforest the level we think it should be? And that's where I think, you know, like a lot of the observability tools currently are at. Or, you know, like is the rain level okay? Or, you know, these kind of like systemic health checks. Mm-hmm. But what I really felt was missing was like, well, okay, like how are the monkeys talking to the trees? And like, you know, like what's actually going on? You know, if the overall health of the rainforest was not good, like how do we go in there and actually figure out which relationships are not working out? And that's where I felt like understanding the system at the API level, so not at the monkey level or the tree level or the total rain level, was going to be really valuable.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really strikes me when I read the blog post and when I hear you talking now is it's really this notion of it's the connectors, right? It's not the components.
Absolutely.
It's the connectors, whether everything's interconnected. That's where I think the rainforest metaphor works so well. We know that there are trees that, you know, that throw out roots, and those trees are actually a one organism, and that they influence each other in ways that we didn't notice. Interconnection and connection is so important for all of this. And that's where I think a lot of this emergent stuff comes from, right? Because it's the connections that create something, and those are hard to measure and those are hard to manage. And I think those are the things that Matt, you know, you talk so much about this when, you know, you talk about complexity theory and you talk about Donella Meadows and all these other things that we've all kind of bounced around before. So I totally get that. What the next thing that just comes to my mind is, okay, then what is Akita? Like what's going on now to help you kind of get towards some of this level about the rainforest?
Yeah, that's a great question. Cause I think especially after I talk about this very abstract, you know, there's a rainforest, there's monkeys, people are like, how does that have anything to do with my actual code? And so very simply put, the long-term vision of Akita is we want to map out all of the connections between, you know, this entire service ecosystem that people have within companies, ideally across companies, just everywhere. Like these interconnects aren't mapped out. People don't have a language for it. There's no way to do it. But you also have to start somewhere. So where Akita is starting is what we do is we have a tool that watches network traffic. So we just watch everything, like all the communication that happens, and we watch it one place at a time. And we turn API traffic into what we call Akita models. And so what we understand in an Akita model is what are the endpoints, what are the data types, what are data formats and eventually what are implicit contracts, like parameter ranges, how one field relates to another field, how different calls relate to different other calls. And you can see there how my formal methods training is coming in, because, you know, that's what people normally try to understand at the language level. I just came to believe the API level was a more fun place to do this. And so what you can do with these API models is now a lot of things. The most simplest thing is you can express it as an API spec, and people can use that for documentation. They can analyze it. They can do a lot of things with it. And you can also use it for diffing. So this is something we discovered. We actually, I think related to something else you planned to ask me about, we pivoted from a security company previously. But the reason we pivoted was we noticed people seemed to want the specs. And then we noticed that people seemed to want the specs for diffing. And what we learned from this is actually people, because they have no clue what's going on with their systems a lot of the time. Well, I shouldn't say no clue. I think I'm being a little dramatic here. You know, there are very many nice developers out there who know a lot of what's going on with their systems, but they remain frustrated because they don't know other things, I think is like the
they know a lot. Even if you know 99%, it's the 1% that kills you.
Yeah. So people don't have a complete clue. Yeah, maybe that's the better way to say it, of what's going on with their systems. And as a result, you know, they're like, hey, I'm having some trouble debugging, or I don't know if some change is just going to take down my entire site. And so the big thing you can do with our Akita models is catch breaking changes. And so we can help you figure out if you've added or removed endpoints. That's a pretty basic one. Added or removed field names, data types, data formats is a big one. And then what people started requesting to us are like, okay, can you do implicit contracts? I want this kind of contract. I want that kind of contract. So that's what we're actively working on now.
Yeah. So interesting.
So I'm gonna jump in here really quick on this contract thing. So is that implicit contract, is that sort of like promise theory, or is it like that abstract, or is it more fundamental, just what your contract is on endpoints and all those other things?
I think, you know, in the limit, you can start building up all kinds of contracts. Like, I mean, one of the things that I dream of is kind of taking all of the like invariant generation specification mining work and just applying it to the API level. But in like very practical terms, a contract is like, you know, this field is always this, or this field is always these range of values when this other field is this. Like pretty basic stuff.
Cool. Go ahead, Matt. I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, I was just something that Mike, you and I talked about very recently about this, the notion of kind of API first design. And we're seeing that a lot in practice. And we were talking about how defining a specification is not really design. Right. I mean, it can be a tool that's sort of used to capture a design, but I think but it can also be a little bit problematic to be trying to really focus on syntax when you may be trying to semantically model things. So I think it's really interesting, Gene. Maybe this is an area where you know, is this where you've sort of applied the formal methods in how to model? Because I think that's that, again, dealing with an industry full of pragmatists. In you know, getting them to really think through the design can be hard, and I think we've seen the API space evolve from just write the API, and then Swagger evolved because you could just generate specs from it, and then people thought, well, what if we came up with the spec first? But I think the idea of modeling and kind of having a you know, kind of a loosely coupled model that is the starting point is a really interesting place.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think this is again a time where you've had an insight into our like never stated anywhere intentions, which I think is really cool. But to me, so for a little bit of context, I spent a lot of grad school being obsessed with specification execution, because I was like, man, why would people write code when you can just write specifications and execute them? Because I was like, this is so much cleaner. It's so beautiful. It's so elegant. And then you realize no one actually knows what their specs should be, and that's why they write the code. Like the code itself is an experiment in what the code should do. And so I came to believe the complete opposite of what I started grad school believing, which is I think no one actually, like, you know, people would love to have specs, but that's kind of like people writing like their life, like most people don't have life goals. And so, if you're sort of to ask people to write goals, a lot of people just write them after they've done the things or just as they're about to, you know, finish doing the last goal. They're like, hey guys, these are my goals. I met them all. And that's how people are with specs. And so I think that a place where, you know, I don't know the API specs community very well. As you know, I'm very new to it. But from listening to the talks that I have, it seems like, you know, the people who have gone spec first, the place where they've struggled is developers often don't know what the specs should be until after they've written the API. There's this nice layer of modeling you can do if you can infer what's going on and tell people this is your de facto spec. And then you can tell people about deviations from it. They can, you know, if you expose the spec to them, they might want to change it or, you know, there's, so I guess to summarize this long rant I've done, I would say many people think of specs as things you should write up front. I've observed this is rarely the case. And I think that specs are really a communication tool. So I see them as a really nice way to summarize what's going on with the system. And then, you know, if you can expose that, then I think editing specs is much more palatable than writing them for a lot of developers. And so if you can actually make the editing actionable and you can diff on that, like that is potentially very powerful.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I often talk about is, I used to work in a field where you laid underground cabling, and people would design the cabling for a new area. I mean, we're going to put the cable here, and it's going to run up this street and down that street. And then you get out there, and you realize there's a boulder buried here. Well, I can't put the cable there, right? So now I have to change my design. I have to change this, and I move this around. But in this field, it's really important that you keep track of these. They were called as-builts. It's like, well, yeah, these are as-designed. This is as built, because what's going to happen is 5 years later, when there's a power outage, somebody's going to dig something up. So this idea of thinking about models versus specs versus analytics, right? So there are lots of models that are created as analytical tools. Like once the thing's been built, we suddenly discover the model emerges. This is a wonderful view on what's actually been created. But that wasn't at all the model that was used to create it. The model is sort of this post construction analytical thing, right? But there are also cases where prototypes and sketches and models are used before a product is built, right? And it may be that the end product doesn't look like any one of those models, but there were models that were used to start. So there's this constant variation in all this, right? And I think one of the things that I liked from one of the blog posts that we've talked about, I think, is this idea that if you're building something that's never existed, you want to build for iteration, right? What does that really mean? What do you mean when you say if it hasn't existed, build for iteration? What's behind that?
So this has become my philosophy, especially with Akita, because what we're doing is trying to build something that takes traffic and models it. And we don't know exactly what people are going to care about with these models. The more people use them, you know, there's always some number of people using this and telling us what they want, but who knows how this relates to general programmers. We might have just gotten some a very skewed set of all programmers. And similarly, we might have gotten exposed to a skewed set of all possible traffic we could be watching. And there's also just a set of learnings with, I guess there are some things that you sort of like a grand cathedral, I guess, is not something you want to iterate on very much as you're building it. Although some of the stories are sort of, then they added these buttresses, then they added these annexes. And so I guess even you iterate on that because, you know, it changes, but you probably don't want to iterate brick by brick. That's too much. But I think that, you know, if what you want, if what you're building is a tool that needs to satisfy both developers, and so this is just going to be scoped to technical tools, because I won't pretend I know anything about, you know, consumer anything. So if you're building for developers and the open dimensions are, how are the developers going to use it? And then also, how good is this tool on the actual, you know, traffic, or like if you're building a compiler, like the actual code, or, you know, the actual whatever inputs the developers actually have. It's sort of like you don't know how things are going to land. And so I think it's really important to to be open to like, okay, we thought that we needed to optimize for this, but we actually needed to optimize that. So one simple way of building for iteration is just not to optimize for anything beforehand, but also to make your system flexible enough so that, you know, you can sort of learn where things are landing well, both because of what people want in their heads and because of what they need things to work on. And so I think that this is probably relevant to people building, like, you know, a lot of tools around APIs are probably like this, but unless you have something that's like tried and true and, you know, it's like the curl command that's been around for a lot of years, you know, you kind of have a pretty good idea of how people want to use it by now. You can either wait for like the sands of time to to tell you what's going on, or you can sort of speed up that process a little bit by really just optimizing the ability to learn very quickly, change things based on what you see and things like that.
Cool. Yeah,
I think Mike, you kind of brought up an interesting topic from a different angle, right? Mm-hmm. And Gene, you know, you're describing building for developers and building for iteration and kind of being able to anticipate what's coming. I think that's kind of in the ethos of the whole black box discovery. Brief side note, I think the idea that the model can evolve, mm-hmm. and can be discovered is something that's extremely powerful, because so much of the modeling tools out there are like Mike said, they're glorified sketches that are out of date even before the product gets to production. Mm-hmm. But I digress. What I want to ask you about is, you know, you can tell we're excited, right? we've been preaching around systems thinking and you know, so much mind meld around, you know, what your perspective is coming into this. But as you go out into the wilds of the customer landscape, you're confronting companies, organizations that have a particular mindset. Maybe they don't have the same assumptions. Maybe they are trying to come up with the unified field theory for, you know, perfection in software engineering, or they're very practically minded. Like, how do you pitch a capability like this, which kind of like, do you find that it requires the mind shift, or do they just, the fact that you solve a practical problem for them is enough?
That's a great question. And that's something I have thought about a lot. The short answer is that we do not lead with anything about models. We do not say specification. We do not say any of these things. What we learned is if we lead with the practical problems, like, hey, breaking changes got you down. You know, have you had these 5 changes in the last year bring you down in some way? Most people say, yes, we have. And then, you know, they ask, how do you solve this problem for me? And if we're, you know, if we're, our answers are satisfactory, they're happy. I think most people don't, they don't really care how it works. Right. I think a good analogy is, I went to a talk by the guy who started Clover Food Truck. I don't know if you're familiar with Clover Food Truck.
No.
But I used to think it was just this rando food truck that was parked outside of MIT. But, you know, it was, the prices were pretty good. It was pretty cheap. And they also didn't have very much meat on their menu, which I'm not a vegetarian, but it was just, you know, like a refreshing change to the menu. Yeah. I went to a talk by the founder of it, and it was actually, he decided to start it after graduating from business school. And it, you know, his dream was actually national food chain, all this stuff, but he had this mission of getting people to eat less meat for environmental reasons. And what he did was he started a food truck that just didn't have meat on the menu, but he didn't advertise it. And they had like all these other things that were amazing. Like it was, the line moved really fast. They optimized like the way they made the food. The food was really high quality. The prices were good. You know, they would park it just like secretly outside of student buildings to attract students for all of the non-vegetarian reasons. And I thought this was totally brilliant, because I think that, you know, if you want something to happen, and announcing it to the world probably won't change very much a lot of the time, because there's probably a reason why that thing hasn't happened yet. But if you give people what they want along a lot of other dimensions, you can, you know, you can have your secret revolution that way.
I think the grand vision, but very practical entry point is great. I mean, it's Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Amazon was speaking of rainforest. Amazon was not, wasn't, hey, let's start an online bookstore, right? Mm-hmm. It was, the vision was, hey, I'm going to be the retailer of everything. It's just that books were a really practical place to start. And I think it goes back to, again, you know, you don't have to, it's the monkey in the rainforest, right? It's not, you don't have to know the inner workings of the monkey to know how it interacts in the rainforest. All these ecosystem ideas, I think, are really interesting. But I think that Clover example and what you're describing in terms of how you're engaging with customers is very much in line with that, knowing where people's incentives are, right? Knowing what's in it for them is so important in dealing with these complex systems and influencing the behavior you want.
Yeah, exactly. I once wrote a blog post about how to create change by giving people exactly what they want. And I think that's one of my life views. You don't change anything if you give people what they don't want.
And I think this all goes, Matt, we've talked about this on the show as well, this idea of value exchange. We're doing this because there's a value exchange. I extract some value. I get something out of this experience. So I think your observation that what we don't sell the details, we don't sell what goes on behind the curtains, because that's hidden. That's like the component. What we sell is what's in front of the curtains, the capability, the connectors, the things that actually change your situation in real life. I think that's an excellent sort of almost full circle to the point you were making at the start of this episode, is that, you know, what's really going on? How can we make things better? So it's really a fascinating way to think about it.
And to dive deeper on that idea, like the part of value exchange, you know, this is a big deal I've been working on for the last year around value dynamics, is actually knowing what your unique value proposition isn't necessarily your unique selling point.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think that's why, you know, as I'm working with companies on business models, delineating where your fundamental value creation happens, it might manifest itself very differently in terms of the value that gets delivered to customers. But
I think that's a really, really good point.
Yeah. There's this thing that I just saw tweeted just a couple of days ago. There's a design thinking trick, which is you insert yourself as the user. You know, when you say, I want to have a really mathematically beautiful way to draw graphs on a page. Well, you're not the user.
Yeah.
The user are the other people, right? So you have to constantly remind yourself that the exchange of value is not what I want to give you. It's what you need. It's the problem you want to solve, right?
Yeah. And I think that this was, this was the other existential crisis I had for most of grad school, which is why does nobody care about any of the stuff we're working on?
Yeah.
And, I remember after my junior year of college, I had taken programming languages and I thought, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. You know, why isn't everyone using functional programming? These types are so nice. And I went to work at Google that summer and they just laughed at me. They were like, we're writing our backend back from Java into C++ because we can't afford the 50% memory overhead. Here you are talking about, you know, OCaml, what the heck? Yeah. And so so I would write to my professors every week. They both the two professors actually literally told me, go have a summer vacation. This is too much for us. But I would say, you know, you taught me all these things, but nobody is using them. And I was really despairing a lot. But I spent the next few years deeply, deeply pondering this question. And what I concluded was, look, like, these are not solving real problems for people. And I get some flack from the functional languages community because I'm like, look, everything that the functional languages community is providing, well, not everything. I also get flack for using my really superlative terms. But many of the things provided by these beautiful languages like Haskell and Clojure and, you know, everything else, they're really luxury goods for developers. And this is something people have given me pushback on. But it's because they're not directly solving a developer problem. And so if they're not satisfying a need, then they're a luxury. And, you know, I think then people are like, we've done so much work to make this more accessible. How can you compare these to, you know, inaccessible elitist things? And it's like, it's not about accessibility. It's really about need.
Yeah. No, it's very
well,
good.
And I have a feeling that, you know, the passion that led you to feel like, why isn't anyone using these things that I think are so great at that time? Probably the problems that was solving for you are still, you know, you're solving them in different ways now. And
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. That's cool.
Awesome.
That's excellent.
This has been a great conversation. Really enjoyed this. Every time we talk, Jean, I learn new things and I'm able to reframe my own thinking. So thank you so much for that. Mike, awesome. You know, you're probably feeling like me, like, you know, hey,
I've got a dozen questions that I'm just going to have to, we'll do this some other time kind of thing, but this has been fantastic. Especially, I really appreciate the journey you've been on. And what also fascinates me so much is that your journey is still very early on, right?
Oh, there's
so much time. Tim Berners-Lee has this great line: the future is so much bigger than the past. So I'm really excited about what's going to be happening with Akita and the kinds of things you're doing now, what you discovered and what you'll be discovering in the future. It's been great. I really appreciate it, Jean. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about it, for telling me so many interesting perspectives. this was really great. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. And thank you to everyone listening. Again, with the third episode into season two, I feel like we've already uncovered many gems, but thanks for listening. Thanks, Jean and Mike, and talk to you next time on APIs Unplugged. Mm-hmm.